Coming up on Fronteras, it's been 150 years since the U.S. Army forced the Navajo and Mescalero Apache to walk 400 miles to a prison camp in eastern New Mexico in an attempt to wipe out their culture.
Just to walk the grounds, a lump in your throat, you know, something bursting forth, you know, that all the anguish of the ancestors. And you can still feel a slight presence there on the edge of the Pecos River.
The long walk, the impacts are still felt today. Supporters of same-sex marriage have seen recent victories in the past few weeks in a number of states. Now some Arizona couples are pushing for change.
It would have been wonderful to have a church filled with people here and our own congregation and our friends. But we just couldn't do it here in Arizona.
A lawsuit challenging Arizona's definition of marriage. But first, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created via an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among seven public radio stations. I'm Crystal Chavez. Across the country, the legal landscape for same-sex marriage is changing and fast. In the Southwest, in recent weeks, courts in New Mexico and Utah have delivered victories to gay marriage proponents. Now, in neighboring Arizona, some gay and lesbian couples are challenging their state's definition of marriage. From the Fronteras desk in Phoenix, Jude Joppy Block reports.
She's soup for supper tonight.
Terry Pochert is serving up soup while his husband, Joe Connolly, puts the final touches on a salad.
We like no-fuss meals.
The couple, both registered Republicans, have been sharing no-fuss meals for almost 19 years. Before they eat, the two men bow their heads.
Come, Lord Jesus, be our guest. Let thy gifts to us be blessed. Amen.
Pochert and Connolly's Lutheran faith is a big reason why they've decided to challenge Arizona laws that don't recognize same-sex marriage. Joe Connolly.
Gay and lesbian people in this state, in faiths where they allow same-sex marriage, but the state does not, it's denying people of gay and lesbian people of faith the right to the sacrament of marriage.
The couple was married legally in California in 2008. Terry Pochert.
It would have been wonderful to have a church filled with people here and our own congregation and our friends, but we just couldn't do it here in Arizona.
Many in the state believe allowing gays to marry would infringe on their own faith, and they've already weighed in. In 2008, Arizona voters approved a constitutional amendment that defined marriages between a man and a woman and reinforced existing state statutes. Earlier this month, Pochert and Connolly filed a lawsuit with three other couples challenging those laws. Sean Aiken, a lawyer who normally specializes in business law, is representing them.
This is a bit far away from the work that I normally do, but what makes it so exciting, I think, for me and every lawyer is these are the kind of cases that we hope to be involved in.
Why? Because Aiken and others hope cases like this one will be landmark civil rights cases. Last June, the Supreme Court struck down part of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, which denied federal marriage benefits to same-sex couples. Aiken's suit relies heavily on that decision.
And to put it simply, it's to say, why can the state government do what the federal government cannot?
The Supreme Court ruling gave same-sex advocates a lot to celebrate, but it left a big question unanswered. Can states ban same-sex marriage? Douglas Nijame is a UC Irvine law professor.
It really opened the floodgates to litigation, both by folks inside the movement and folks outside the movement. So that's why we've seen now almost 40 lawsuits pending around the country in a variety of states.
Lately, the pace of change has been dizzying. In New Mexico, the state's highest court ruled last month that same-sex couples could marry. The next day, a federal district judge in Utah struck down that state's ban. Federal judges in Ohio and Oklahoma have also sided with gay couples. But despite this, Nijame says this legal debate is far from settled.
Even though we've seen district courts favoring same-sex couples' claims in the last few weeks, we're likely to see other decisions come out the other way.
In other words, future rulings might say that states can choose to only recognize marriages between a man and a woman. In the past, uncertainty in the courts meant the LGBT movement attempted to carefully plot out its legal moves. But there's been a flurry of new litigation happening all over lately. Jenny Pizer from the national LGBT group Lambda Legal says the energy is exciting, but it's vital all parties pushing for change coordinate.
With any issue where a court case affects not just the litigants, but a whole community of people, folks in that community try to plan and work together to try to have good results in cases like that, because everybody has to live with the result.
Any one of these pending lawsuits could wind up in front of the Supreme Court, which could then decide for the whole country whether states must recognize same-sex marriage. In Phoenix, I'm Jude Joffe Block.
This month marks the 150th anniversary of what Navajo and Mescalero Apache people call the Long Walk. It's similar to the forced march known as the Trail of Tears. In 1864, the U.S. Army forced the Navajo and Apache to walk 400 miles from their reservation in northeastern Arizona to the edge of the Pecos River in eastern New Mexico. Thousands died. From the Changing America Desk in Flagstaff, Laurel Morales reports.
So many Navajos, like musician Clarence Clearwater, have moved off the reservation for work. Clearwater performs on the Grand Canyon Railway, the lone Indian among dozens of cowboys and train robbers entertaining tourists.
I always tell people I'm there to temper the cowboys. You know, I'm there to give people the knowledge that there was more of the West than just cowboys.
Clearwater retraced his great-great-great-grandfather's footsteps 50 years ago for the Long Walk's 100th anniversary. Along the way, he learned this song.
Shinasha, 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 shinasha.
The song translates, "I'm going home. It's a long ways, but I'm happy I'm going home."
When we were on that long walk, that was a song that I heard all the way over there and back. You know, it was very powerful.
Clearwater says the stories he heard as he walked are haunting. A Navajo family gave away their baby to a non-native family so the infant would have a better chance at survival. Many drowned crossing the Rio Grande.
Some of the older people were talking about how elders like themselves had just been left out in the desert, you know, left where they fell.
The consequences of the long walk we still live with today.
Jennifer Danette Dale is a historian and a University of New Mexico professor. She says severe poverty, addiction, suicide, crime on the reservation all have their roots in the long walk.
So I think it's really been a struggle to believe in our own ability to create on the Navajo Nation institutions and structures that will bring about prosperity and a way to live well.
They walked to Fort Sumner, which was essentially a prison camp where Colonel Kit Carson attempted to, quote, tame the savages. Today, a giant mural there commemorates the long walk. On one panel, swirls of red and orange, the desert heat, a long line of families, a child on his mother's back, a fallen elder, his son helping him up. Behind them, a soldier on horseback cracks a whip. Navajo artist Shanto Begay painted the mural.
I could feel and hear, you know, the cries of the people, the trail, the heat, the cold, just to walk the grounds, a lump in your throat. Something bursting forth, you know, that all the anguish of the ancestors.
The Navajo culture is intrinsically tied to the earth. Begay says many live or frequently return to the place where their umbilical cords are buried.
When your umbilical cord is buried in the earth and is held by the earth, and you know it's held by the earth, and you know the ground where it is, you know, you feel at home and welcome anywhere in the world.
The Long Walk was among many attempts by the federal government to wipe out Native culture. Others include sending Native children to boarding schools to eradicate their traditions. Begay says he was 5 years old, out herding sheep, when a man driving a flatbed truck gave him candy and hauled him away.
I grew up with a different name, a government name, Wilson. There was a lot of dead presidents and generals. the early 1980s, I reclaimed my great-grandmother's name, Shanto.
Shanto, it means light dancing on water. It is also the name of his town, his home, where he remains connected today. He wants his children and grandchildren to know their ancestors' suffering and determination meant something.
You know, hey, their forefathers survived. Make something of it. Honor it.
I'm Laurel Morales in Flagstaff.
Shinasha, 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 Ujoshotehenea. Shinasha, 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 Ujoshotehenea. Hala, hala, gonasha. Hala, hala, gonasha.
Solar parasols are part of a new sustainability initiative for Parisian outdoor cafes. The environmentally friendly heaters and air filters are being supplied by a futuristic design company based in Tijuana and San Diego called Amorfica. Brooke Binkowski has more from Tijuana.
Winter in Paris is chilly and damp. That's why the ubiquitous Parisian cafe has used outdoor heaters to keep clients warm. But the fumes from those heaters have created a problem. Julia Sarud is an associate architect at Amorfica.
They just banned the use of gas outdoor heaters in Paris because of all the emissions they cause. So they were looking for something that was more sustainable.
Add to that the fact you can't smoke inside cafes and restaurants in Paris anymore. Amorfica founder Aaron Gutierrez-Cortez says that means everyone crowds the patios when they want to light up.
There's usually mixed-use buildings in Paris, which means that there's a cafe at the bottom, and then there's living areas or living units on top. So the smoke always gets in the nerves of people upstairs.
Enter the urban parasol. It actually doesn't look exactly like a parasol, more like a light but sturdy awning with brightly colored solar panels. Those provide power to heat the space below and filter smoky air. The design won a worldwide call for an innovative and environmentally friendly solution to Paris's cafe problem. They're spending 2014 designing the prototypes. If Paris likes them, they'll order more. Meanwhile, Amorfica is seeing interest from Mexico, Brazil, and Portland, Oregon. I'm Brooke Binkowski in Tijuana.
New Mexico received the highest grade in the nation for its spending on efforts to curb smoking, according to a new report. But as Tristan Autone reports, states in the Southwest generally receive poor to failing grades in regards to tobacco prevention.
According to the American Lung Association, New Mexico, Arizona, California, Nevada, and Texas all received Fs for their tobacco prevention efforts. That's primarily because the states aren't spending amounts recommended by the Centers for Disease Control. Texas got the worst grades in the Southwest, including an F for smoke-free air and restrictions. Arizona received high marks with a C for the amount of taxes assessed on cigarettes, $2 a pack, while New Mexico received a B for its spending on smoking cessation coverage. Joanna DeMaria is with the American Lung Association.
New Mexico had the highest cessation grade in the country, and that's due to our extensive coverage by insurance plans and our investment per smoker for the quit line.
New Mexico spends nearly $7 per smoker looking to quit, while on the other end, Nevada dropped about $1 per smoker. The CDC recommends cessation programs spend about $10.50 per smoker. Nationally, states average out to a D for tobacco prevention efforts. In Albuquerque, I'm Tristan Autone.
There's still more Fronteras coming up. The latest report from the U.S. Drought Monitor warned western states can't expect any relief from the ongoing drought. Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. Newly confirmed Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson recently spent time traveling in the Border Patrol's busiest regions, South Texas and Southern Arizona. Michelle Marisco reports on the secretary's first trip to the border.
Johnson said he met with ranchers and local law enforcement along the Arizona border Tuesday. He said while those he met with were pleased with the Border Patrol's work, he saw there was still more to be done to raise security levels along the border. He also said he wanted to see more transparency in cases of use of force by his federal agents.
I think it's crucial for law enforcement to have accountability and credibility in the areas in which they operate.
Since 2010, Border Patrol agents have killed at least 18 people. Most of those cases remain unresolved, and the names of agents involved are rarely disclosed. The secretary may be new on the job, but he's absorbing many of the problems left in place when Janet Napolitano left the cabinet position last year. Among those, complaints from border residents. Hours before Johnson arrived, residents of the tiny town of Aravaca protested outside the Border Patrol headquarters in Tucson. They have complained for months about harassment and unfair scrutiny at a small immigration checkpoint outside of town. Peter Reagan says folks there are going to start monitoring the agents.
And we'll be watching. We'll also be documenting, you know, with still photo and video cameras.
Those checks of Johnson's border agents will start next month. In Tucson, I'm Michel Marisco.
Even though areas have seen precipitation this week, the latest report from the U.S. Drought Monitor warned western states can't expect any relief from the ongoing drought. The dry spell will further strain the region's water supply. We called up climatologist Brian Fuchs with the National Drought Mitigation Center in Nebraska. He joins us now to talk about the drought.
Yeah, in Texas right now, you know, currently according to the U.S. Drought Monitor map, we're still at almost 46% of the state is in drought. And when we look at the areas that we consider abnormally dry but not in drought, we're over 76% of the state. So what that is telling us that as we go into 2014, that the drought conditions that we have been dealing with through much of Texas over the last several years still have a ways to go as far as completely eradicating the drought and showing complete improvement. And with that being said, you know, winter is typically a drier time of year, so we try to make up some ground during the winter. But for the most part, this winter's been fairly dry. There has been some precipitation in parts of the state, but it has been scattered. And you mentioned a winter storm coming through here. That could certainly help to bring some moisture to some areas.
And is that the picture we're seeing along just the whole southwest portion? Is the whole southwest in drought status?
Yeah, and we start looking at the southwestern U.S. as a whole, and what we are seeing is all the way from Southern California through Arizona and New Mexico into Texas, there is a lot of drought. And what we're seeing is some of these areas did pick up some good precipitation in the late summer and fall associated with the seasonal monsoon, especially in parts of Arizona and New Mexico, as well as in portions of West Texas. And this was some of the first good precipitation that some of these areas had seen in quite a while. But since then, it has been dry again. And we start looking at areas in eastern New Mexico and into the Texas Panhandle and even further north in neighboring states of Colorado and Kansas. A lot of these areas have went quite a while without any significant moisture to speak of. And so the concerns of drought is definitely continuing. And we've even had some impacts as far as blowing dust and some dust storms out in some of those areas as well this winter.
I feel like we've been talking of drought for a while, and I'm sure our listeners feel the same way and think, oh gosh, how much rain do we need? What do we really need to pull us out of a drought?
That's a great question, and a lot of times with what we've been looking at in Texas especially is we're in a multi-year drought situation. And so if I start pulling up the data and going back to 2010 to present, we're going to look at a lot of the state having a fairly significant deficit of precipitation during that time. But what that does mean is at some point in time, we just know that deficit is not going to get made up if we look at the last 4 years and think that we're going to realistically have normal precipitation plus enough precipitation to make up that deficit. That's not going to happen. And so what we do start looking at is how quickly the landscape responds to precipitation, meaning how quickly do we see water going back into rivers and streams and reservoirs and lakes when we do see these rain events. And we did see quite a bit of that in the eastern part of the state over the last 6 to 8 months or so, and drought conditions were improved and alleviated through a lot of East Texas because we did see that response. Even though I could pull up the precipitation statistics and still show deficits, the response was there and we started seeing improvements to some of the areas that were impacted by drought. So I guess that's what we're really looking for is what's it going to take to cure these impacts in the state? When are we going to see the reservoirs and lakes recover? When are we going to see the response in groundwater as well as rivers and streams? When are we going to see the soil moisture return and not seeing crops and cattle production being impacted? Those are the keys that we're going to be looking at, that not only did we see precipitation, but what utility, what good came out of that precipitation.
Texas's population is growing, so it's only going to put more demand on our water infrastructure. While I realize this may be out of your purview as sort of a drought expert, what do you see we need as a state infrastructure-wise?
Well, I think you're exactly right, and it's not only in Texas, but it's a lot of the Southwest as a whole. There's a lot of population shift moving south, and we see a lot more straws in the same bucket, so to speak. And what that does mean is for municipal water suppliers and water managers, it does put a lot of stress on them because they have systems in place and storage in place that was developed for a certain population level and then probably some growth as well. Well, when you start reaching those growth levels and you start meeting the maximum capacity of some of this infrastructure, it does mean that there are going to be some decisions that need to be made as far as what is needed in additional to what we already have. And it does become a question of, is the drought situation that we've seen, is that going to be a shift to a trend that we're going to see more than likely in the future? Does it mean that this population shift is going to continue and at what level? And aging infrastructure is also a problem. Some of these wells and even reservoirs that were developed a long time ago have reached some age capacity as well. So you have to start looking into replacing or improving upon existing infrastructure as well. And it does become complicated, but it is a question that I know in the state of Texas they've been working on, and it is positive to see that they are being proactive and not just waiting until there is no solution.
That was Brian Fuchs of the National Drought Mitigation Center. You've been listening to Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations KNAU Flagstaff, KRWG Las Cruces, KNPR Las Vegas, KJZZ Phoenix, KPBS San Diego, KUAZ Tucson, KXWT West Texas Public Radio, KRTS Marfa, and KSTX San Antonio. We're online at fronterasdesk.org. We're on Facebook. Join the conversations and post your thoughts about our stories. For headlines and updates, follow us on Twitter. Our main handle is at fronterasdesk. I'm at Crystal R. Chavez. This theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.